we're ready to proceed with the oral argument in Fekete Homes versus Sliman.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the court. My name is Bill Leone, registration number 11403. I'm representing the appellant Fekete Homes this morning. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes of my argument for rebuttal.
Okay, I'll keep my eye on the clock for you.
All right, thank you, Your Honor. Our time is short today, so please, as I'm sure you don't need this invitation, but interrupt me and ask whatever questions you have. I want to make sure that we address the issues that are most important to you. The law in this case, Your Honors, I think is fairly clear. We cite it in our briefs. It's best articulated by the excerpt from the Corbin Treatise cited at page 18 of our brief. And essentially, what that law provides, and it's best represented by the Cole opinion from our state, is that in the construction contract setting, time is not normally of the essence with respect to the performance of the contract by the contractor. This is a species of contract that's been recognized by the courts to involve inherent delays, inherent risk of delays. There's conventions that have developed in the industry to specify a time for completion or a time for commencement and a time for completion of the work. It is not at all uncommon for these contracts to provide a measure of liquidated damages for a delay in the performance of the contract.
Talk about Cole for a minute. Does Cole require a time of the essence language in a contract to make time a material fact or a material term?
Your Honor, Cole, I think, stands for this proposition. Cole cites to three factors that it finds as a matter of law compel a holding that time was not of the essence in that construction contract.
Well, before we go there, what was the principle? Wasn't the principle in Cole that said something to the effect of, you know, time is of the essence when there's an express provision or the facts of the contract or the facts of the case so provide?
It does say when there is an express provision or the facts of the case so provide.
Okay.
That is close to the language out of the case.
Well, let me ask you about this case. If the facts of the case so provide, couldn't the trial court find that the term was material based not only on the language of the contract, but also from the testimony provided at trial?
Not under Cole, I don't think, Your Honor.
Under the facts of the case?
Well, Cole addresses this question, and the other authorities that we cite address this question. And because I looked very hard at this question, is this a question of fact or is it a question of law? And the cases treat this species of case as a question of law. Cole's an example. The trial court found, based on the record at that case, in that case, at trial, that time was of the essence, even though it was not explicitly stated to be such in the contract. Court of Appeals reversed that finding as a matter of law, citing those three factors that I described. One factor was the contract does not say time is of the essence, and that is a really important factor, because if the parties had wanted this to be a time is of the essence contract, they could have said that, but they didn't. The second factor is, does there language in the contract that suggests that the time for completion is something other than a solid, drop-dead, end-of-the-world date? In Cole, the court referred to the fact that the time for completion was referred to as an estimate. That is exactly what we have in this case. That six-week time for completion was referred to as an estimated time for completion.
Is the three-month period of time referred to as an estimated period of time?
No, Your Honor, but the $200 per day provision does not limit itself to the six-week period. If you read that $200 per day provision, it says that you get $200 per day for every day of delay over the allotted time for completion.
Mr. Leone, why should we not conclude that 200-day provision only applies to the kinds of delays that are specified within Exhibit A of the contract? In other words, it only goes into effect if one of those types of delays is invoked.
First, Your Honor, the contract doesn't say that. Secondly, there was no testimony to the effect that that was what it was limited to. Third, Your Honor, it's completely inconsistent with the entire record in the trial court in this case. If you look at our reply brief, where we talk about was this a liquidated damages provision or not, that list of 15 admissions by the Slimans during the course of this case, at every important stage of the litigation, complaint, counterclaim, trial data certificates, arguments, and in trial. And if you look at the court's ruling, not one time during the entire course of this trial, until this appeal, has anyone argued that $200 per day is limited solely to the kinds of delays, like a delay in the architectural drawings or weather, that are referenced in the contract. To the contrary, the Slimans sought in their counterclaim and received in the trial court's award $200 per day for every day after the completion of the three-month period, not for after completion of the six-week period. The trial court ran the $200 per day from April 15th, which was the conclusion of the three-month period. And that is exactly what the Slimans asked for.
Well, they seem to suggest in their briefs that they were entitled to those other 10 days too, but they weren't going to make a big deal of it.
Well, Your Honor, all I can say is that the argument at trial was that the liquidated damages applied to both periods. And if you think about it, it makes sense. Here would be the example. Let's assume that the work began on day one of the three-month period and was completed within 6 weeks. There'd be no liquidated damages because both time periods are satisfied. If the work had begun on day one of the three-month period and lasted 8 weeks, there would have been liquidated damages to pay, even though the work was completed within the three-month period. If the work had begun 2 months and 3 weeks into the three-month period and been completed in 4 weeks, there would have been liquidated damages to pay. In other words, when the contract says that the remedy for a delay is $200 per day for any delay over the allotted completion time, you can apply that language to the six-week period and the three-month period, giving both of them meaning and achieve the result, the intended result.
Let me ask you, that may, assuming you're right on that applies only if the other party didn't have the right to terminate the contract, doesn't it?
That's right.
And so they could terminate upon a material breach. Your view is these two periods or completion within these periods are not material. But let me ask you, under your theory, could you have delayed the repairs for an indefinite period of time, just paying $200 a day for however long it took?
No. And let me address that, because there's a misstatement in the appellee's brief on this point. Appellee cites and says, well, And that same misstatement is captured in the trial court's findings, which were prepared by the appellees. Fichetti never took the position in this case that it was entitled to delay its performance indefinitely.
Well, let me ask you about that, because you're right. You say they have a May 24th. They came up with a May 24th date, and so therefore they weren't planning to indefinitely postpone. But could the Slimans, looking at things as of April 26th, based on Fichetti's performance to that period of time, including the performance after the last 10 days, work slowing, could they have reasonably determined that there's no way that Fichetti's going to make that deadline either, and therefore why should we put any stock in any date Fichetti gives us? And would that be a question of fact to be resolved by the fact finder?
Your Honor, respectfully, under the case law, let me back up a step. I believe it is true that in the normal case, whether there's been a breach and whether that breach has been material is a question of fact for the trier of fact. And if you look at the Colorado jury instructions, for example, there are jury instructions on the question of, is it a major breach or a minor breach, okay? But in the construction context, that this is the issue, whether or not you can determine in this limited species of cases as a matter of law where the only breach is a delay. And the only breach found for the trial court here was a delay. Not an abandonment, not a repudiation, not a complete failure to perform, just delay.
Right.
It's the only breach.
But even if time is not of the essence, cannot delay become a material term if the delay is for an unreasonable period of time?
Your Honor, there might be a case. Look, I can imagine a case. We could all imagine a case where if the contractor were to say to the Slimans, I can't complete the work on time. I don't know how long it's going to take me to complete the work. I can't tell you. or I've got other jobs I've got to do first, I'll get back to you when I can, where you could say, under those circumstances, we have something that's approaching an abandonment, and that would become a question of fact.
But what
not
what,
on this record.
What about on this record, where you've got basically on April 26th or April 29th, and saying, oh, by May 24th, we'll complete it, even though our history so far hasn't been all that good? Does it become a question of fact to determine whether or not the Simons were acting unreasonably when they thought, gee, there's no chance of they'll get this done in a reasonable period of time?
The trial court didn't treat it that way. The trial court accepted that completion schedule. And the trial court relied on it, by the way, in finding a breach.
Mr. Leone, in your view, does the contract or the settlement agreement have any time limit in terms of how long the $200 per day provision would be in effect?
The agreement does not have a specific outer limit on that. The agreement does not specify that. I can't find any language in the agreement.
Oh, I understand that, but let's say there were a 6-month delay. Would at any point after 6 months or after 9 months, would the Slimans have a right to any other remedy than $200 per day, in your view?
I don't know, Your Honor. We don't have that case before us. I think there, if you got into a situation where, where the record was different than what we have, where there was not a completion date scheduled, where the trial court had not accepted that completion schedule, where the trial court had not relied on that completion schedule for part of its findings, and you had some kind of different communications between the parties, then you might have a question of fact. But that's not what we have in this case. We have a delay. It's the only breach. We have a specific period of delay. We don't have any findings by the trial court that 37 days was unacceptable. We have a record that says that the work was completed by someone else in 37 days, which is about the time that Fichetti said it could be completed. We just don't have that case in front of us. What we have in front of us is a case where the trial court awarded both actual and liquidated damages, where the trial court wrote the $200 per day out of the agreement, where the trial court reinstated essentially the original underlying claims for breach and awarded damages based on the same theory that would have been applicable had there never been a settlement agreement at all. As a result, the Slimans have the settlement payment of $31,000. They have all of the work that was done by Fichetti for 6 weeks. They have the benefit of all of that. They were able to complete the house and build extra things into it. And they were able to charge the entire overage to Fichetti on a contract where the parties thought they had settled the conflict by agreeing we'll do the work in this period of time, and if we don't, we'll pay $200 a day.
Mr. Leone, I know you said you wanted to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, and I also know Judge Fox had a question for you.
I'll reserve it for when you come back.
Judge Daly also has a question, though.
I do have a question, but I'd ask the presiding judge if he'd consider stopping the clock and letting Mr. Leone answer this without or giving him additional time, however you want to do it. Mr. Leone, didn't the trial court also base its award on a promissory estoppel theory? Wasn't that an alternative basis for the award of damages? And I didn't see you appeal a promissory estoppel theory or measure of damages related to that. Didn't you need to do that if you wanted to challenge this ruling?
Your Honor, I believe that the promissory estoppel theory collapses into the contract theory, because where you have a contract that specifies what the result should be, that answers the question under either theory. And so in reading the trial court's order and conclusion of law, I certainly did not differentiate those to be completely independent theories of decision. I think the decision hinges entirely on a finding of whether or not this was a liquidated damages clause. I think the appellees concede that in their briefs. They have raised only two arguments. Was this a material breach, and was this a liquidated damages clause? And the was it a liquidated damages clause is answered so resoundingly by positions taken at the trial court that there just can't be any question about it, that it was, that it applied to the 6 weeks and the 3 months, because that's the way it was litigated, that's the way it was applied below. The only question, and it's a fair question, is whether or not a delay is a material breach. And that is why we resort and look to the case law in this type of case. And there are a number of cases that we cite in there where this question is treated as a matter of law on the facts presented in those cases. It's a little hard to say what exactly the standard is. It's not quite a no reasonable person standard. The court in Wyoming granted summary judgment in the bonding case that we cite, the St. Paul case on this, found as a matter of law, despite all the arguments that it was material and it was too long and it was too great, that the contract seemed to contemplate that there might be delays. Same thing is true of the other Colorado cases where the court does not specifically articulate a standard of review for the finding in this construction contract setting. Cole is the best case where you can see very vividly that the court treats it as a matter of law that we have this.
Mr. Leone, your time is up, but here's what we're going to do. In light of the fact that you wanted to reserve some time for rebuttal and in light of the number of questions that we've already asked you and in light of the fact that Judge Fox at least has a question to ask you, we will afford you 3 minutes additional time for rebuttal. Mr. McShane, to be fair, if you need additional time, you will also have 3 additional minutes for your oral argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
May it please the court. Again, I'm Chad McShane. I represent John and Stacy Sliman, bar number 30462. I think I'm going to start right out by addressing a few of the questions that the court had where I disagree with some of the recitations to the record. First of all, there was some discussion about the Cole versus Parker Yale case. That case certainly does stand for the fact that time may be of the essence to an agreement when the parties so state, but you don't need to use the magical language, quote, time is of the essence, unquote. Here, this settlement agreement had many different time periods demonstrating that time was important, as well as some outside circumstances surrounding the prior litigation and the settlement agreement that the court took into consideration as facts in the record.
Is important the standard of materiality, or does it have to be a little bit more important than important? It could be a material term in the contract. Usually terms are important. Usually we put terms into a contract because we think they're important, but not all terms are material.
If this were a settlement agreement that had nothing more than Fichetti Homes is going to do these repairs and they're going to do them in 6 weeks, and if they can't do them in 6 weeks, then as long as it takes them, they'll pay $200 a day, we'd have a different case here. But that's not what that settlement agreement says. It has multiple time periods in there. The reference to them repeatedly indicates the materiality of those terms. The three-month period in the body of the agreement itself, the deadline in which the engineer had to get plans to Fichetti before they could start actual repairs versus demolition is a material term to that agreement. The Slimans would have reached that settlement agreement if we hadn't got the plans to Fichetti by the date certain. In addition, that six-week period that is in the exhibit to the settlement agreement is another material term, but that term only pertains to delays that are contemplated to compensate Mr. and Mrs. Sliman for meals and lodging.
Sorry, Judge.
Mr. McShane, if time was of the essence in the settlement agreement, then how does that square with the $200 a day provision for exceeding the time period?
So I believe there are two material terms here, and I believe the trial court got it right. I think it's paragraph 24 of the trial court's judgment. It finds that the six-week provision in Exhibit 8 of the settlement agreement pertains to $200 a day intended to compensate for lodging and meal expenses after, at Fichetti's request, Mr. and Mrs. Sliman had vacated their home free of charge for 6 weeks. Fichetti could start that work whenever they wanted, but the three-month period was a drop-dead deadline. So you have two terms here. You have a $200 a day if you don't finish within 6 weeks, and the remedy there for that breach, for that particular injury and that breach, is $200 a day as compensation. You have another material term of this agreement, which is the three-month term, after which there is no ability to perform.
In your view, the $200 a day provision is only operative for 3 weeks? Between the end of the six-week period and the end of the three-month period?
Actually, less than 3 weeks, Your Honor. It would have been April 5th to 15th. And contrary to what Mr. Leone had indicated at trial, and actually as well as the initial disclosures provided by the Slimans in the trial management order, the arguments at trial were consistent. We wanted $200 a day from April 5th through the 15th. After that, we presented evidence of actual costs for meals and lodging, which did exceed $200 a day. The trial court rejected that. We disagree with that rejection.
Counsel, under your argument, how does the provision that there could be weather delays, unforeseen material delays, and inspection delays, how does that factor into your argument? Because, you know, clearly there was some contemplation that something could happen outside the control of the home builder.
In the facts of this case, that didn't happen. There were no such delays. Had those come up, I don't know if we'd even be here today.
Oh, no, Judge.
But I'm sorry.
Can you see our clock?
No, everything has gone dark. Yeah.
Let me ask the bailiff, do you have any idea why the clock is not working? Oh, it just went. Okay, it just went on. Okay, please continue then.
Since I lost whatever the last question was, I'll continue with addressing.
Well, I have a question for you. You know, is it your view that the 3-month period is a drop-dead deadline? Is that based on unambiguous language in the contract, or is it based on testimony at trial?
It is actually based on a combination. The reason.
So, in other words, it's not unambiguous. It's not unambiguous language. Ambiguous.
3 months meant 3 months. This was not a new construction of a
3 months means 3 months, but it's a drop-dead deadline.
It is a drop-dead deadline.
You think any time period you set as an outer limit is a drop-dead deadline?
In this case, it is, Your Honor.
In this case. Why is it in this case? Is it the language of the agreement, or is it the testimony that makes it in this case?
In this case, I believe it's the language of agreement. In the agreement, I also believe it was supported by the trial court's findings of the circumstances surrounding this and the expectations of the parties. This wasn't construction of a new property. This is a defective home that they weren't allowed to live in the lower levels for 3 or 4 years, that completion time was everything, because that was the main concern. Getting this done in time to get landscaping and things like that done by the summer were material to this agreement. They were discussed by the parties. That's why the 3 months is in there.
Let me ask you another question, Counselor. Your opposing counsel, I asked him a series of questions about, okay, even if it wasn't a material term, what about the prospect of unreasonable delay being perhaps a material breach? I take it you're not arguing that. You're arguing basically it's a drop-dead deadline. That's the material term. We don't need anything else. For a material breach.
In this case, yes. Had there been arguments about delays, engineering delays, weather delays, things like that brought into the facts of the case and made known to the parties prior to the expiration of this term, we may not be here. But that wasn't part of the record in this case.
No, the question I'm asking is, again, you're not arguing that the Slimans had a right to terminate the contract based on whatever belief they had that Fachetti would not complete the repairs by May 24th. You're not arguing that. You didn't argue it below. You're not arguing it here.
No, I think the date is April 15th is the
truth. No, remember they came up and said on April 26th, we think we can get it done by May 24th. You're not arguing that that date was either unreasonable or was not likely to believe.
I do believe it was unlikely to be believed because there were no assurances.
Are you arguing that?
But I'm not arguing that. That agreement expired on April 15th.
Okay.
The May 24th deal to me it just has no application to this case. It was post-agreement, post-expiration settlement discussions. There was failure to even substantially perform the agreement. That was a major breach when the 3 months expired. There wasn't substantial performance. The parties then tried to try to patch this together so the Slimans didn't have to take on bids and contractors on their own. The May 24th date was proposed. The parties couldn't agree to it because Fachetti wouldn't set that in stone, wouldn't provide assurances that that was the date. I also disagree with Mr. Leone's characterization of the testimony at trial regarding how long Fachetti could perform on this case. I specifically went into questions about what $200 a day meant to Mr. Black, who was the principal of Fachetti, and he all but told me the $200 a day is all I'm responsible for. And I asked, put a scenario to him, what if this takes you 6 months to a year to finish this project? And he said, well, that's unrealistic. And I said, but under your theory, it'd be $200 a day. He agreed. Fachetti tries to ignore, they only focus on the $200 a day in the Exhibit A, which relates to the compensation for the meals and lodging if they go outside those 6 weeks. they completely ignore the three-month term, which was in the body of the agreement, and really, to me, the key term of this agreement.
Mr. McShane, one of the things that's puzzled me about the agreement is that it seems like the parties are only discussing it in terms of delay, but was there any provision that would have applied if Fichetti had done some work, but it was done in a substandard or negligent manner?
There are two things there, Your Honor. Number one, there is a provision in the agreement that it has to be inspected and done according to the engineer's plans, that engineer being the Slimans engineer. So if those problems had arisen, that's how they would have been dealt with. But this is certainly not an agreement where once you hit the 3 months, there's a spelled out remedy between the parties on what's going to happen, because as written and as intended by the Slimans, it just expired. And being myself and the opposing counsel being familiar with construction remedies know that the remedy is, if you fail to substantially perform by the time that contract expires or by the completion date, the remedy is to put, in this case, the homeowners back in the position they would have occupied had the breach not occurred, and that was the cost to finish this construction.
What would be substantial performance in this case? You know, as you say, you know, you didn't expect them then to have completed the project by April 15th. Substantial performance.
When they started the work at the week one of 6 weeks, we did expect them to complete the work within 6 weeks. And then when that didn't happen, we also then knew they weren't going to make the 15th of April, and that's why the termination was made. But there wasn't even any, there's nothing in the record by either Fichetti or by the Slimans that would indicate we're anywhere close to substantial completion. In my mind, the case law on substantial completion is you're down to punch list work, you're in the 90 percentile range of completion. Here we are in the 25 to 35 percentile range of completion. It wasn't even close.
Is there evidence in that about in the 25 to 30 percent range?
I believe Mr. Sliman testified at trial to the 25 percent figure. And I also believe that may be in the, I'm not positive, it may be in the judgment by the trial court as well.
But your agreement does not provide what happens if the work doesn't pass inspection, right? You say that there's a provision for an inspection.
Nothing in the settlement agreement about inspections, that's correct.
So, Mr. McShane, let me pick up on Judge Fox's earlier question about the delay exceptions. If, for example, there had been weather delays, how would that have fit into the time periods in the settlement agreement under your understanding?
Under my understanding, let's assume it rained for 3 days and there was a request for a 3-day extension. That request would have been granted subject to still completing within the 3 months. Fichetti proceeded at the time they did at their own peril. They could have started in January of 2010 with the demolition work. They chose to wait until about 5 weeks after the settlement agreement was signed to start their work.
But if there had been rain, as you're suggesting, hypothetically for 3 days, would that also have triggered Fichetti's responsibility to pay $200 a day?
No. The provision is, in my mind, clear with respect to $200 a day. Weather, rain, and agreed delays absolve them from the $200 a day for compensation. That didn't happen in the case, but that would have absolved them from that responsibility.
Did Fichetti share that understanding of the delay provision?
They didn't share that understanding at trial. They said nothing about it. I think my trial exhibits are exhibits B and C, where there's emails exchanged at the time of the expiration of the 6 weeks and right up to the expiration of the 3 months, where I indicate, look, the $200 a day are accruing, and we're about ready to breach this entire agreement when the 3 months hits. There was no response to that. We didn't get a response on this issue of delays and other problems until after April 15th had passed. One of the cases that I wanted to bring to the court's attention, because Fichetti's argument throughout is $200 a day is a liquidated damages provision. That's the only remedy in this case. I've already told you that I believe there is a $200 a day provision that stipulated damages that pertain to a 6-week period, and that's designed to compensate for meal and lodging expenses, and that the 3-month period is a separate material term. The case law that supports that actually was first cited by Fichetti. It's the Bassett construction case. And in Bassett, the court said, where a contract provides for payment of stipulated damages for a particular breach, the stipulation is applicable only to that breach. I think that case is right on set by Fichetti. It was included in our answer brief. Here, the $200 a day is stipulated. No one disagreed at trial that it was provide meal and lodging expenses. That's what it was for. The second term we have in here is the 3-month term. So,
second. The $200 a day is linked to delay. It's not linked to a particular 6-month or 3-month period. Why do you see in the text a link to only the 6 weeks but not the 3-month period?
If the language both of Exhibit A talk about the completion time is the completion time for repairs in the 6 weeks. That is a standalone provision in Exhibit A to the agreement. The body of the settlement agreement referring to the 3 months is the drop dead date. I don't see a relation between the two because the 3 months is not at all linked to delays or anything else. It's just a drop dead date. If we intended to link the 3 months to this 6-week estimated schedule with delays, we would have said so. It doesn't say that. It's a 3-month term giving Fichetti the flexibility to do that work within their 6 weeks within that period.
Mr. McShane, suppose Fichetti had waited until 6 weeks before the end of the 3-month period to start the further work. Could it have done so under your settlement agreement?
So I make sure I understand the scenario. There's 6 weeks left before April 15th hits, and Fichetti starts work?
Right.
Perfectly acceptable. And actually, it was, I believe, as a trial exhibit, because I had my concerns about how late they were starting, and I advised the council that I wasn't sure if they started right up to 6 weeks, assuming no delays, that there wouldn't be any, I think I used the term wiggle room, to finish the work.
Right, but so my follow-up question is this. If they started 6 weeks before April 15th, then if I understand your earlier argument correctly, the $200 per day provision would never or couldn't it never have taken effect. Is that correct?
That would be correct. It would be a drop-dead date. The three-month period would have expired. They left themselves no room for delays. The other case I did want to bring to the attention, actually two of them, first was cited by Fichetti, which is Medema Homes versus Lynn, the other being City of Westminster versus Centric Jones. Assuming here, for the sake of argument on this appeal, that the only remedy here in this case is $200 a day, and Fichetti could go on as long as they wanted to finish these repairs for $200 a day, the findings of fact by the trial court were that Fichetti was the sole cause of these delays. There were no other delays. Fichetti now concedes that on appeal. I believe both of those cases I've just referred to stand for the proposition that what Fichetti's trying to do here is enforce what it says is the only damages provision for breach, $200 a day, at what they call a delay clause. I believe both of those cases stand for the proposition that the party who is a cause, either whole and part, of that delay, cannot enforce that provision. And I believe those cases are right on point here, to the extent this court even considers this to be a liquidated damages clause and the only breach, in which case Fichetti wouldn't recover anyway. We'd be back to actual damages, which is exactly what was argued at the trial court and what we briefed here before the court. So Fichetti doesn't prevail in whether they've got only one provision for liquidated damages or this court adopts my belief on what this agreement means, which is a 3-month expiration and within it a 6-month provision for compensation for meals and lodging.
Did Fichetti advance at trial an argument that the Slymans caused or contributed to their delay? Did they fault the homeowners?
They did not fault the Slymans directly. I believe there was testimony at trial regarding alleged engineering delays. I believe there was testimony at trial regarding issues, and those delays are combined with, I guess, plans, issues regarding plans. They were made at trial. The court found, I guess, insufficient evidence that those delays were brought up, and certainly they were not brought up before the April 15th term expired. Again, these are questions of fact that the trial court found, and that's why I think we have a disagreement here as to the standard of review not being strictly de novo. We have mixed questions of law and fact here, and these factual findings, I do not believe, are clearly erroneous, and nor do they need to be set aside. This judgment should be affirmed. And in addition, not argued by Mr. Leone in our opening arguments, there's also the issue here of attorney fees. The parties have already agreed there's a prevailing party provision. They've stipulated to the recovery of fees by the Slymans, subject to what happens on this appeal. And it was mentioned in my answer brief, but we're also seeking our fees associated with
this. Well, let me ask you about that, counsel, because under 39.5, you have to state the grounds in your answer brief for attorney fees. And I may be wrong, and correct me if I'm wrong, but I saw a reference to attorney fees incurred on appeal in about half a sentence without any reference to the basis, you know, the prevailing party provision or not, without any basis, you know, for an award of attorney fees. Am I wrong about that?
Your Honor, it was a very short address in my answer brief, and it did refer to the prevailing party fee provision in the settlement agreement, which is part of the record.
In your request for attorney fees on appeal, you referred to the prevailing party provision.
I believe I did, Your Honor.
Okay, thank you.
I see I'm out of time. I thank you for your time. I am happy to answer any other questions.
You do have a couple of extra minutes if you would like to use them, as I indicated before.
I think I've used those minutes.
Oh, okay. All right. Thank you. I've been corrected, and we appreciate your argument. Thank you. So, Mr. Leone, now you have 3 minutes of additional time for your rebuttal.
Let me try and address a couple of the questions that were raised during Mr. McShane's argument. The first is whether or not the prospect of unreasonable delay might make the delay material. I suppose it's possible that the trial court might have heard evidence about that and might have made a finding about that, and that might change the appeal. But there aren't any findings to that effect in the conclusions of law or the finding.
There are arguments to that effect?
Not that I could find in the record, Your Honor. In addition, there was no testimony about the 3 months being the drop-dead date. I scoured the record for a testimony from the Slimans that their understanding of the 3 months was that it was a drop-dead date. There's not one reference to it. If you scour the record, you find the only evidence, the testimony that discusses the $200 per day provision is that of Mr. Black, who said that it applied to both delays. I don't even get there much in our brief because we can read the words of the agreement, and that's another reason that makes this a question of law. If it's just a question of interpreting the words in the contract is clear on its face. It says that the $200 per day applies if there's any delay in the allotted time for completion. It does not limit it to
six. What is your position with regard to other types of breaches, not a delay breach, but say Fichetti had completed the work, but it was shoddy work. Would the Slimans have any remedies in that case?
I don't, yes.
What remedies would they have?
Well, remember, the trial court found only one breach, and that's delay. So none of those other breaches are at issue. But if the Slimans had been able to prove other breaches, then the trial court would have had to consider whether those breaches were so material that they constituted a failure to substantially perform. And then the court would have had to have fashioned remedies for those breaches. The example would be, I agreed to paint the house green, I delivered you a house painted yellow. The question is whether or not that's a substantial failure to perform. Is that breach a condition? Does it relieve the party of performance, or does it just entitle you to damages?
And then they would get actual damages. They would not be limited to any kind of liquidated damage.
The liquidated damage provision, you're right, applies only to delay. That is the breach to which it is directed. That is the breach to which it applies. There's no liquidated damages for any other breach, other than breach of confidentiality, but that really is not part of this appeal. Your Honor, Mr. McShane refers to the Bassett Construction case. That case stands for exactly that proposition, that the liquidated damages provision applies to the breach to which it applies, but not to other breaches. So we don't have any of those other breaches on the table here. That's an abandonment case, by the way. That is the case that tells you what happens if the contractor just doesn't perform at all. The Medina and City of Westminster cases, Your Honor, we address that in our motion to strike. These arguments were not raised on it below or in the appellee's opening brief. Those cases don't have anything to do with our case. Those cases just stand for the proposition that if an owner tries to seek liquidated damages for delay, and the owner has caused the delay and interfered with the performance, then the owner can't recover it. But that is all those apply to, and they were never argued below. That's what we're going to strike. That's all.
Mr. Leone, your additional time is now up.
Thank you.
We appreciate both arguments from counsel. We had an unusual number of questions for each of you this morning, so we appreciate your responsiveness to our questions. The case will stand submitted, and a written opinion will issue in due course.